You've got enough on your plate. Mundane meals shouldn't be one of them. Get an endless variety of the freshest, best-tasting food from award-winning chefs delivered to your door with Cookunity, all at a fraction of the cost and time you're spending now. Cookunity offers hundreds of meals prepared by their roster of all-star chefs. Simply choose from their innovative variety or let them surprise you. Menus are updated weekly, and new chefs are always joining the team. So you'll have fun discovering new favorites while avoiding the dreaded dinner rut. No cleanup or meal planning. Just easy and effortless meals delivered fully cooked that heat up in as little as 5 minutes. Speaking of easy, Cookunity is flexible and commitment-free. Skip deliveries, pause, or cancel anytime. Take a load off and leave your meal prep to Cookunity. Affordable food crafted by award-winning chefs delivered straight to your door. Go to cookunity.com/podcast or enter code podcast before checkout for 50% off your first week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
And we are back. Crossover NBA podcast. Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. I am coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. I finally made it home after a couple of weeks of doing a little boxing and basketball touring of the country. Beck, you are in the Bay Area. You're home away from home, or home region, I guess, right? You're a Bay Area native, correct?
That is correct. You are right. San Jose native, proudly, love being back here, take every excuse I can to get back here. But no, working on a feature that is Warriors related, is not Draymond Green or Jordan Poole related. It is not TMZ related. It is not video leakage related. I just happen to be here on a previously arranged trip to work on a Warriors preseason feature that is nevertheless something I'm very happy about and excited to put together and put out there in the world. But no, it is not related to the controversy du jour. So,
all right, I want to get into that. I also want to get into the Clippers, who look absolutely loaded right now in the preseason. I want to get into Rob Pelinka getting a vote of confidence, some money behind it from the Los Angeles Lakers as well. Before we jump into it, though, Howard, Jeremy Wu, our draft insider, is going to join me later in the show, and we're going to take a look back at the Victor Wembanyama experience last week in Las Vegas. But one thing I wanted to hit you on, like every NBA executive is salivating over Victor Wembanyama, and I was tweeting some stuff that I was being told. I know other reporters tweeting stuff about the tanking and how early it's going to happen this year. It got to the ears of Adam Silver when he was in Abu Dhabi, and he gave kind of an awkward answer to it. Like, I really hope the teams play hard when, you know, I think we both know that if teams have a chance to do whatever they have to do to solidify a bottom three spot, they're going to do it this year. But, like, are we about to see, like, after the All-Star break, a historic level of tanking? Do you think it could get, like, to an embarrassing level? I mean, we've seen close to embarrassing levels. I mean, like what Oklahoma City did a couple of years ago, where they just sat Al Horford, who was healthy. They sat Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who probably could have kept playing. They sat Lou Dort, like, one of the weird ways it was explained to me by someone in Oklahoma City was like, you know, Lou Dort has to get ready for the Canadian national team or something like that. It was just like, we've seen some brazen tanking in recent years, but are we about to see it get taken to the next level?
So it's interesting because I think the NBA ran kind of a modest victory lap, Chris, over the last couple of years, and an earned one, where they did two things to try to stem tanking. And this was mostly in the wake of the Sixers, the process, right? That was an embarrassment for the league. Adam Silver was appalled and embarrassed and very uncomfortable with all the discussions surrounding the Sixers. And they weren't the only ones during that time, of course, by the way. They were just the only ones with a multi-year plan to be as bad as possible, as long as possible, and get as many high picks as possible. But plenty of other teams were tanking for the Wiggins draft, which now seems quaint in retrospect, and for various other drafts. Like, it's always been the case. But the NBA did two things. They reshifted the lottery odds, which went into effect. I think the Zion draft was the first one a few years back. And then, of course, they introduced the midseason tournament coming out of the bubble because, the play-in tournament. I still hate the idea of the midseason tournament, but that's coming soon eventually. That's a whole other thing. The play-in tournament happened in the bubble out of more of circumstance. They liked the results. They created a version of it for the regular season. They've had it for the last 2 years. It's now a permanent part of the NBA, where 7 through 10 in each conference participate in the play-in. And that has incentivized teams not to tank. It's incentivized teams to, if you're in the 11 or 12 range, but have a chance to get to 10 and be in the play-in, which then gives you a chance to be in the playoffs, it has incentivized teams to still compete in March and April and go for it. And we've seen it. Like, that wasn't just theory. It was just theory beforehand. But the last 2 years have shown that their hunch was right. There's now incentive if you're, you know, somewhere within range of six, the last guaranteed playoff spot, you tried everything you can in the late part of the season to get sixth instead of seventh so that you're not in the play-in. And if you're in that 7 through 10 range, you're all incentivized to try to get to six if you can. And if you're anywhere in shouting range of 10, you're incentivized. So there's incentives all throughout. And of course, we know the top four have home court advantage. There are incentives all throughout. And it has done a great job in making teams actually give a crap about March and April games, all but the last two or three teams in each conference who are out of it by then. But what's going to happen now, Chris, what I would fear, what the league I think should be rightfully fearing right now, is that Wembanyama and the combination of Wembanyama and Scoot Henderson, who in any other draft, any other recent draft, would have probably been number one, it means that teams aren't saying, well, I'm going all out to suck just for a 14% chance, which is what you have if you have one of the three worst records. They all have an equal 14% chance of number one pick. Now it's, well, those three spots have a 27% chance of being the first or second pick. So now the idea is, well, I don't, you know, I'm going to go all out to get Wembanyama if I can. And if I don't get him because the lottery balls don't fall my way, well, there's still a pretty good chance I'm number two and I get Scoot Henderson, who could anchor my team and be a star of my team for the next 10 years. So this is where it gets interesting. It's two players, not just one. I'm not saying they're equal, but it is a player that, you know, everybody would be gladly have fall to them. And Wembanyama, the way teams are talking about him in these like historic terms, best prospect since LeBron, best prospect in recent memory. Some people, you know, there was the one report somebody said, you know, that somebody had said it was, he's the best prospect ever. Like, let's slow down just a little bit. But certainly one of the greatest prospects of the last 20, 30 years. And that's going to make people take more chances. And I'll just finish on this note, which is, okay, when you're one of the three worst teams under the current lottery odds, you all have an equal 14% chance. So there's no incentive to be the worst. There's no incentive to be the 30th team. If you're 29th or 28th, you get the same odds as the 30th team. But it goes from 14% chance to win the number one pick to 12.5% if you're the fourth worst team, to 10.5% if you're the fifth worst, to 9% if you're the sixth worst. So all the way through six, there's a, you know, if you've got at least a 1 in 10 shot, you might be incentivized to go, you know, try to avoid the play-in now and avoid the playoffs to be one of the bottom six or bottom seven. I mean, this could go the other direction this time, and we won't know, Mannix, until we get there. And we'll know soon enough anyway, because early in the season, if teams start cashing out early, the first sign of stumbling, and they start trading off veterans to the top contenders and pull the plug, we'll know. So I don't want to predict there's going to be like a tankathon to end all tankathons, as I'm looking at the site tankathon.com. But It's possible. Like the framework is set. The seeds are there for this to be an ugly race to the bottom for a whole bunch of teams.
Now it's going to be an ugly race at the bottom. I'm just curious to see which teams join that race in like month two or month three of the regular season. I mean, San Antonio is already in that race. Utah is already in that race. If there's an injury in Houston early on, do they offload Eric Gordon and join that race? Does Indiana come up with a trade that moves Buddy Hield and Miles Turner off the roster in exchange for a Russell Westbrook or a player they don't want? And do they join that race? That's to me the only question.
Which was like, probably going to happen anyway, by the way. Wembanyama or no Wembanyama, the idea of Indiana trading off its last two veterans in a Westbrook deal or whatever, I think that was possibly going to happen anyway. So this is where it gets sticky, right? We'll start conflating things that were maybe going to happen anyway with, oh, they joined the tanking race.
I mean, that's really the only one, though. Like, that's yeah, the one. Like, Indiana moving those guys. Like, I think Houston, you know, before it became Wembanyama fever, like, they went to the season hoping they could win more games. Not going to be a playoff team, but, like, can they get to 25, 30 wins, you know, this season? More from Jalen Green, something out of, you know, Jabari Smith, Alperen Sengun, Kevin. Like, they've got a lot of young pieces there, like, that they can take a step forward. Like, they're the one. Utah traded everybody, so, yeah, and they'll continue to trade everybody. Mike Conley's, the clock's ticking on him. Even if they don't, they can't defend anybody anymore, so they're going to be really bad. So I'm just curious to see how many teams by All-Star break are in this race. Like, are there four teams competing for those last three spots where your odds are the very best?
Well, all right, so listen, this is the interesting part. As I'm looking at the teams that could potentially join the tanking race, right? You mentioned the Spurs and the Jazz, they already made their decision, right? The Jazz jettisoned Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert. They're going to be bad intentionally and for reasons that have nothing, that could have come about without Wembanyama, right? They had reached, they did hit a wall. They weren't going any further with this group. It was time to hit the reset button. But anyway, Utah and San Antonio, and San Antonio, of course, offloaded DeJounte Murray. So those two teams, we know what their trajectory is. We know what their intent is this season. No question. Houston is going to be bad regardless. It's only a question of degree. Oklahoma is going to be bad regardless. Only a question of degree. You mentioned Indiana. They can easily jettison a couple vets and be in there. But here's the interesting thing. Like, the Magic have not made the playoffs in 1,000 years and have added Paolo Banchero as the, you know, top pick of the last draft. I don't think the Magic are going to be very good anyway. I don't think they're a play-in team anyway. And certainly they're a team that if they're not going to make the play-in anyway, they can, you know, start messing around down the stretch to be ultra bad. But their front office has now been in their seats for, what, 3-4 years? And don't have a lot to show for it. You know, there could be pressure there from ownership to actually show something for it and not be historically bad again. The Pistons have had a couple of good drafts and now actually traded for a veteran in Bojan Bogdanović, as if they're trying to win now. The Pistons want to show progress with their young core. The Sacramento Kings have showed us the last couple of years, though they've failed at it, they keep trying to make even the play-in because the Kings want to end their historic playoff drought that's now at 16 years. The Washington Wizards signed Bradley Beal to another massive extension. They want to make it. And again, that doesn't mean they can't blow it up midstream, but, you know, the Knicks don't want to bottom out. Like, they're another one of these teams that could be in the lottery again, as a lower lottery team, not a high lottery team. But, like, they're not a team that's going to suddenly change direction, trade everybody, and go for Wembanyama. The Trailblazers are patching it together around Damian Lillard as he got healthy again and have added, you know, Gary Payton Jr. and Jeremy Grant. They're not trying to do it. So, like, a lot of the teams that we would look at normally and say, oh, they should just pull the plug and go for it, are teams that actually have incentive to try to win, either to keep their owners happy, to keep their stars happy, or just because they're kind of pot committed to being mediocre like the Knicks.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. I just think, again, midseason, if there's an injury or two and a team's like, you know, the teams, as you pointed out, that went for the 10 seed last year are not going to be doing that this year. If they can find a way to get into that bottom three or even closer to that bottom three, they're going to do it just because this kid is transformational. And if you are a small market team and you have the chance to add this guy for the equivalent of like 8 years, really, because everybody signs that second contract, you're going to do whatever you have to do to go and get him. So Jeremy Wu and I will talk about that, more about Wembanyama later in the show. But I do want to talk this show, Howard, about Draymond Green. The Draymond Green fiasco has had a couple of twists and turns over the last week. It was reported early last week that Draymond got into an altercation with Jordan Poole. It was later revealed he punched Jordan Poole, settled down for like a day, and then the video of the altercation leaked to TMZ, and that could not possibly have gone worse for Draymond Green. It showed Draymond walking over to Jordan Poole, Jordan Poole shoving Draymond Green, though not, didn't really move him. He's got like, he's down like 40 pounds on Draymond, or 30 pounds on Draymond. And then Draymond just winding up and throwing and landing a huge right hand to the face of Jordan Poole. Here's Draymond Green, Steve Kerr, and Kevon Looney talking about the incident.
Whenever adversity hit, this team usually responds the right way. And this is the ultimate test for us. And I think we're going to be able to get through it. Jordan, he's going to work and do what he's going to do. And Draymond, he's a veteran. He's been the leader on his team for a reason. And, he got some work to do to get that trust back from us. But I think he's willing to do it. So,
all right, Howard, let's just start here. You know, your take on what happened, how it's evolved, and what this means for the Warriors.
Let me start with this. There's absolutely no minimizing what happened, right? Even if we had never seen the video, the act is the act. That we have seen the video and we can see just how violent it was, how scary it was, how aggressive it was, there's just no minimizing that. And, you know, there's a lot of other things swirling around how the video got out. And, you know, I know there's this backlash of how it doesn't matter how the video. Well, actually kind of does matter how the video got out. Like that's an issue too. It's not the most important issue, but it's an issue. It is especially an issue for the Warriors. And I think it's probably an issue to a degree for all 30 teams because nobody wants their stuff getting out. And I don't mean about just fights. I mean, whatever, trade secrets, whatever they're working on, other stuff, you know, and yeah, dust ups in practice, whatever. Like nobody wants their video getting out. This has never happened, to my knowledge, in my 25 years covering the NBA. And teams are definitely alarmed about it. The Warriors chiefly, but I think everybody is now a little worried about what is vulnerable within their four walls that they believe to be private. But the act is what matters, right? The punch is what matters and the effects of it. And the fact is, like a week later, Chris, I don't think we really know what the effects are. This is the longest I've ever seen a team or the league wait to announce a disciplinary measure. It's possible they've made a decision and just have not announced it. It's possible that Draymond's absence right now is part of it. Like, that's absolutely a possibility. We don't know one way or the other whether he's voluntarily staying home to clear his head and to let the team clear their heads without him around, or whether this is part of some agreement with the team. We don't know one way or the other. But this is the longest I've ever seen that a team has not announced a disciplinary action after something so egregious. They can do that because it's preseason. There's no urgency. If this were the middle of January, they probably would have had to act more swiftly because the season keeps marching on. But they have some time to breathe here before opening night, which is now a week away. I expect that whatever is happening, we'll find out by then, probably sooner. But the Warriors don't. You know, I'm out here right now, right? And I'm not working on that. I'm working on something else, but I've been chatting with people. They do not seem to be in any rush to do anything here. I know that there's a lot of people in public, whether it's, you know, people like us in media or whether it's fans, you know, screaming, demanding whatever, justice, whatever they think that is. The Warriors, I would just say this. They know Draymond Green better than any of us. They know their team better than any of us. They know what the balancing act is. And it is a balancing act. And it's always been a balancing act because of Draymond, the way he's wired. They know what the balancing act is between keeping Draymond, engaged and active and hopefully channeled in the right direction versus Draymond possibly going off the rails. He has nearly derailed them and arguably has derailed them a couple times before. But he's still here because he's also helped them win all those championships. Like, those banners are there. There are four of them. And Draymond Green is as critical to them as anybody. And so they have smoothed out the rough edges over time. They have weathered Draymond Green's various outbursts over time, usually verbal and not physical, to our knowledge. And they know better than we do what that line is, what that balancing act is, what that razor's edge that they're sometimes on is. And
yeah, but that line, Howard, that line has been, it's been crossed. Like, it has been leaped over. Like, I don't want to hear from NBA executives, coaches, about stuff like this happens in practice all the time. Altercations happen all the time. Scuffles happen all the time. Haymakers to your teammate do not happen all the time. They don't. I'm sorry.
Not all the time, but I guarantee you they've happened.
Okay, but like, but you know what? When they do happen, like, suspensions come. You remember, what was it, 2017, Nikola Mirotic, when Bobby Portis slugged him at Bulls practice, Mirotic was going at him, and Portis was quick to point out on social media that he was defending himself in that situation. But he got, 8 games for that. Like, and that wasn't caught on camera. That's just something that happened at practice, and the Bulls felt it significant enough to level an 8-game suspension at this guy. So, like, I just don't believe stuff like that happens all the time.
How many games did Michael Jordan get for slugging Steve Kerr back in the day? I think zero. How many games did Shaq and Kobe get for their fight that we didn't learn about until years later? Wow.
If Shaq had hit Kobe, though, we would have found out.
But like, we often Kobe don't hear dead. About these things like,
that
until...
That would have been just a complete beating right there.
Right, but the point is that in a prior era, before social media, before all these cameras in their gyms that now capture everything and that can now be, you know, like, we don't know how that video got out. We don't know what chain of actions happened that it got into somebody's hands who didn't mind making a buck off of it. Several. I doubt that it was anybody who works for the Warriors. Like, it makes no sense at all that's anybody who works for the Warriors. It makes more sense that somebody showed it to somebody who shouldn't have, and then that person showed it to somebody. And in this day and age, with the technology being the way it is, it's so easy to copy and send on stuff. That wasn't the case in prior decades. And so if a punch like this happened in practice, and again, I guarantee you it didn't get out because there was no means for it to get out. And so it's not that this is unprecedented. It's just that the circumstances and our ability to see it are unprecedented. And had the video not gotten out, you and I would be sitting here talking about, well, you know, something happened. We don't know exactly what, but Draymond Green apparently punched. Like, we wouldn't know. We would be talking about this in the abstract, and the team would probably be dealing with it in a way that...
Yeah, but here's why, Howard, they now can't deal with it in that way. Because
it is out, yeah.
It's out, and not just because it's out for public consumption. It's out for internal consumption too. Like, you watch that video and Draymond saunters up to Poole. Poor Ron Adams. Like, Ron Adams, I made this analogy on Twitter, was like the boxing referee that knows if he just stepped in a second earlier, he might have stopped something really bad
from
happening.
Ron Adams needs to be protected at all costs, and I'm so glad that he was not in harm's way and that nobody tumbled into him, that nothing else happened. Ron Adams must be saved.
It would be like Pedro Martinez and Don Zimmer from back in the day when, for people that don't know that reference, you can Google that. When you watch that video, a game is going on, a scrimmage is happening on the floor. Most of the Warriors players did not see that altercation unfold. They saw the fallout from that altercation. Yeah. They saw Jordan pulled down, these guys getting separated. I'm sure that most of the Warriors just assumed it was something relatively minor, that it was Draymond in his face, they wound up pushing each other, grabs. All of a sudden, every Warriors player is waking up last week and seeing video of Draymond just hauling off and throwing a right hand at the chin of his teammate. and look, Draymond is someone who has built a lot of equity with that team. You articulated it very nicely there. The 4 championships, all he's done for that organization. But as you heard Kevon Looney say, he does have some amends to make. It's not as simple as saying, yeah, I'm sorry, and saying I'm sorry to Jordan Poole's family. This is something that's going to take some time to get over. And part of getting over it, I think, is going to be a sizable suspension. Now, I don't know how long that's going to be. Do you give him the 8 games that Bobby Portis got for slugging Nikola Mirotic. Remember Carmelo Anthony back in the day? He got 15 games for slugging Marty Collins in a game.
That was again, in a that game. Was, yeah, but that's right, a that's right. That's an NBA suspension. That's a fight that spilled into the stands, and it was a year removed from the Malice at the Palace. Very, very different circumstances.
Right, and speaking of Malice in the Palace, Meta World Peace got, I think, 7 games for that James Harden elbow that he hit him in the playoffs years ago.
I think he
ago.
Gave him a concussion.
He did. That was a vicious
well,
elbow.
Right, quick, can we quickly do this, since you're the boxing guy anyway? Like, the damage matters. Mirotic had multiple fractures in his face, did he not?
I believe he had damage. I don't know what the...
He had damage. And Harden was I believe, concussed. Jordan Poole played last night, as we record this. It was a Sunday night. And played really well. Like, it's not to... Again, not to downplay the punch. But there was no damage. And it's just like with a flagrant foul, right? Like, the same action, if a guy falls to the floor hard and smacks his head or, you know, busts something on the way down, it's viewed differently than if the guy fell hard and hopped right back up, right? So sometimes it's the impact. And while we're on it, let me just say this, because I want to come back to this point. It's not what you and I think about it or what the public thinks about it after having seen the video. It's what the Warriors think they need to do as a pragmatic matter to both make sure there's accountability, make sure that Draymond Green is held to account and held to a standard and that this does not just pass by, but at the same time, consider how important and intrinsic he has been to their success. Because, by the way, they could win another championship. And they want to win another championship. They want to get that fifth banner. And Draymond helped them get the first four. So it's not to say that his ability to help them win championships outweighs everything. Of course not. But there's some weird, difficult, sometimes awkward balance that you have to find. And that they have been finding throughout his entire career here. And that's what they're doing again right now, trying to figure out how do you keep him still in the fold and engaged and then also honor his teammates who have been, you know, one of whom has been punched and the rest of whom have had their trust in him shattered or at least fractured for the moment. You have to, it's all of these people matter, right? And including Draymond, unless they're going to go to the extreme, which I don't think that's there, but like Tim Kawakami, who covers Bay Area sports and then the Warriors very well for The Athletic, among others, Kawakami made the point that we have to go straight to the big picture. That, you know, Draymond can be a free agent next summer. He's got a team option for the following season. Is this the point where he's turning 33 in March? He's shown some signs of eroding physically. Like, is this the point where you just say, you know what, this is one thing too many, and you move on? Like, it's fair to raise that, but I'm telling you, like, as I read it from what I can gather at the moment, they are looking at the bigger picture here of all of it, this season and beyond, but especially this season. Can we win another championship? Can we go back to back again? Is Draymond a net plus? In that, if he still is, then let's figure out how to both make sure that we hold him accountable and do the right thing by everybody here, but at the same time, not alienate him or alienate anybody else along the way. Like, it's a very delicate dance they're doing, but again, they've been doing this a long time as an organization.
I think what this inevitably means, though, is that Draymond is not getting that contract extension before next summer.
Like, he might not have been anyway.
He might have been anyway, but I think this puts the final nail in that coffin. And Jordan Poole, I think a lot of this, how it plays out, is going to depend on how Jordan Poole reacts to all this. Like, he has not yet spoken publicly about what happened. Like, is he going to be in that forgive and forget mindset? We're all going to come back together. We're going to win a championship. We don't know what their relationship was like prior to that punch. I don't think what was happening on that floor was the beginning of something. It might have been a continuation of some bad feelings between those two. I mean, and look, if you're the Warriors, like, playing the season out is not a bad thing anyway. I mean, before you commit big dollars, and Draymond's throwing the word max around in the past, before you commit big dollars to Draymond Green, I kind of want to see not only what does he look like as a player at this stage, because he's still an elite team defender. He is a big part of the fluidity of their offense. Even if the numbers don't show it, his ball movement is instrumental to what they do offensively. But if he takes a little bit of a step back in both areas this year, it might put the Warriors in a position to want to move on. So besides that, And seeing how the pool stuff plays out, I mean, Draymond's going to be playing for his next contract. He has a player option for next year, so he can opt in, but I'm sure he wants to opt out and maximize his value before he gets too old for a team to want to give him that money. So, you know, it's going to cost him a lot, Howard. Like that shot, that punch, that video, it's probably cost him a lot of money. He can get that money back potentially, but it's probably cost him a lot of money at this point. And I am very interested to see how Jordan Poole reacts. Like, I don't know if he's scheduled to speak in the next couple of days. He's going to have to speak at some point. How he responds will go a long way towards telling us, the public, how this story plays out. Don't you agree? Like, if he's like, fuck that guy, like, that's a problem for Golden State. He's probably not going to do that. But if he's like that, Golden State has an all new headache on its hand.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think that, you know, it's not to say that the Warriors' entire decision, and it's a momentous decision, right? This is not some fringe player. It's Draymond freaking Green. He's really important to them, as we've established. So they're not going to have this decision made by any one person. Not, you know, Steph Curry's voice obviously looms huge in all of this, and he and Draymond have been, you know, have built a really important and solid partnership over years here. So, you know, Steph's voice and his opinion in this will matter. Andre Iguodala, who's been around throughout this entire dynasty, his voice will matter. All the usual front office people and all the coaching staff and Steve Kerr. But Jordan Poole, as a young guy in this league who just had his breakout season last year and who, as you've noted, is up for a massive extension and is viewed as a critical part of their future, he's not the kind of player who in ordinary times, not an all-star, not all NBA, he's not usually the kind of player who you would look at and say he's going to be able to make this kind of decision on the behalf of the franchise. But there's a lot that rides on his reaction. You're right. You're absolutely right. They're giving him as much time as, like, I don't even think it's as much time as he needs. I think the organization has kind of decided he's just not going to talk for several days here, just to like let this whole thing, you know, kind of simmer down a little bit before he goes into the hornet's nest of a press conference to talk about what happened. And, you know, especially after the whole world got to see it. I don't know his personality that well, but he's pretty low key. My experience just watching him through the conference finals and finals last year, through a lot of press conferences, he's not really fond of press conferences. Like, he's comfortable enough and he's like a good, you know, engaging, fun personality, but he kind of has this running joke. I can't remember what it is, but where he looks at Raymond Ritter, the PR guy, and says, you know, something about one question, right? Or something like that as he goes in. Like, he doesn't like doing the press conferences. So he's not going to be comfortable being put in this position at all. And I don't get the sense he's the kind of player or the kind of person who's also going to be like, yeah, I'm, you know, my way or the highway, or it's me or him, or that. Like, that's not, I don't perceive that that's who he is. I'd be shocked if Jordan Poole's going to be the one to say we can't get past this or something. I don't think that'll be the case. If I had to predict, and this is just a hunch, my prediction is that Steph will want Draymond still here. My prediction is that Steve Kerr, having already ridden many waves with Draymond Green, will be willing to ride this one out too. And my hunch is that Jordan Poole is not the kind of person who's going to say that we can't coexist now. My guess is Draymond Green is here, and if he's not playing opening night because there's a suspension, okay, but he's going to be here for whatever the first game is that he's eligible for and throughout the rest of the season, because he can help them win a fifth championship.
Yeah, that's all that matters. I thought it was interesting, Stephen A. going out on TV saying this is Draymond's last year in Golden State. Who knows where he's getting his information, but that's not going to help the pot from not being stirred.
Yeah.
It's just going to keep.
And I will just note real quick, I just want to say this much too. Like, Draymond Green did not have to sit in front of the media for 40 minutes on Saturday. Draymond Green did not have to talk at all. Draymond Green could have talked on his podcast. He could have issued a two-sentence statement, written statement through the team. There's a whole bunch of ways he could have done this. Look, no amount of contrition and no amount of sitting on a podium and speaking openly, you know, for 40 minutes doesn't negate what he did. Let's be very clear. I don't want anybody to misread it. But accountability is about sitting up there and facing the music. And he did it. Within a day of this video leaking, he was up there speaking with the Bay Area media for 40 freaking minutes. There are teams in this league, and we don't have to name them, who don't have anybody speak for 40 minutes combined on a given day, and who have GMs who don't speak 40 minutes combined over the last several years. Bob Myers was out there on day one, the second the story broke, speaking to the media and trying to be as accountable and as transparent within reason as he could. Steve Kerr was out immediately. Steph Curry was out immediately. And Draymond Green, having thrown the punch that the whole world saw, sat up there for 40 minutes to be accountable, to answer questions, to be transparent, to be contrite, and to say, I accept responsibility for it. It doesn't negate what happened at all, but it speaks, I think, well of the organization and of Draymond Green that everybody's willing to just address this openly and not hide from it and not try to downplay it.
Yeah, I agree. Good for him for standing up there and facing the music for as long as he did. Now we'll see if there's a pathway back for him to for the Warriors get back on the same page. Howard, good stuff, man. Next week, we're going to have games. So we'll talk basketball and basketball stuff. How about that?
How about that? That's exciting. I guess our last pod before the actual game start will be...
Well, it'll be on... Game start. Yeah. Yeah, when game starts. Tuesday, opening night. Tuesday the, 19th? Yeah, we're good to go.
There we
man.
Go. There we go. I will be in Brooklyn watching the Nets take on the new Zion and the new Pelicans.
I will be in Boston watching Celtics 76ers.
With their new coach.
We'll do it again next week, Howard.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
All right, the biggest story in the NBA last week had nothing to do with this NBA season. The story was Victor Wembanyama, the 7'4" French big man who had two phenomenal games in Las Vegas, 30-plus points, scored in a variety of different ways, defended in a variety of different ways, and had... anyone who knows anything about the NBA gushing over him in the last week as we get our first U.S. look at the future number one pick in the 2023 NBA draft. Jeremy Wu, our draft insider, had a bird's eye view of Victor Wembanyama. He was in Las Vegas. He went to the games, was at the practices, talked to a lot of people, I'm sure, out in Vegas. Jeremy joins me here on the show. So, Jeremy, I want to start kind of here. What if anything, did you learn about Victor Wembanyama that you didn't going into this two-game experience?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, yeah, so it was my first time seeing him live. And, you know, a large chunk of the NBA, I think, can say the same. You know, as you know, like, not everyone works internationally. You know, not everyone went over. We had the pandemic. So, you know, the visibility thing was a big factor for him coming over here. And, you know, just from my standpoint, you know, I probably watched coming in, I guess, between like 5 and 7 of his games over time, like on Synergy and with, you know, the France youth teams and whatever, you know. So I'm familiar with what he did, or I was coming in. But I think up close, you know, just getting the sense of his sheer size, you know, we know he's really tall. It's not news, but, you know, you see it in person. You see how it impacts other people going into the paint. You know, all the area he covers, just seeing it up close, it's kind of different. I think the biggest thing, though, was just his, he didn't always shoot it like this. You know, I don't think he's ever made 7 threes in a game before. So to show up on this stage and do that, it's pretty eye opening. But, you know, I wasn't certain that he was this good of a shooter. Clearly, he's progressing really, really well. And just the ball handling, man, like, it's really kind of messes with your head. I mean, no matter how much basketball you've watched, like, we've seen a lot of basketball and just how comfortable he is. I mean, he does have guard-like skills. Like, I wasn't sure, you know, if it was fair, you know, to bill it that way, but you see it now and you know, I'm sitting there in practice and he goes between his legs 3 times into a mid-range jumper. He didn't make the shot, but that wasn't the point, right? So, you know, everybody, I think, had to kind of recalibrate their expectations, you know, because oftentimes we hear a lot of the hype, but these matchups don't turn out, you know, with the results you want and guys don't necessarily step up. And there's all kinds of things that can go wrong. And obviously, you know, Scoot Henderson getting hurt was the thing that went wrong in the second game. But, you know, from Victor's standpoint, I mean, it was quite a coming out party. And, you know, it would be hard to be disappointed. And if you were, I mean, that's kind of your problem, right? I mean, it's really amazing stuff.
Yeah, it was all over social media, those, especially the first game. I think the first game when everybody got their first look at Wembanyama, everybody was talking about it. Like football people were on Twitter talking about it. We're kind of in that era or eras where we talk a lot about, I've never seen anything like it, right? Like LeBron comes into the draft in 03. And you're like, I've never seen anything like this guy who's 6'7", 6'8", built like a middle linebacker, the most physically developed 18-year-old that I've ever seen. Giannis comes into the draft. We don't really know as much. He went mid-first round. But you get to like year 3, 4 of Giannis, you're like, I've never seen anything like this. This guy can, you know, play up-tempo, can score in a variety of different ways, defend a variety of different ways. Wembanyama seems to me like to blow both of them out of the water when it comes to we've never seen anything like it. Like, we have literally never seen a player with that type of size play with that type of perimeter game. Like, his ability, and look, part of me felt like he was trying to take out the whole bag over those two games. Like, he was trying to show a little bit of everything. I loved his interview the day before the first game where he's like, I know everybody's here to see me. I know all the eyeballs that are going to be on this. I love that. So he came into this with the right mindset that he was going to show out. But like, I've never seen anyone kind of just drift into the corner, take a fadeaway three-pointer, pull up from 26 feet away, it seemed like, from the left elbow. I mean, he's just got more ability at 18 than any other player I've ever seen, including LeBron, obviously Giannis, and all the other prep to pro guys we've seen come into the NBA. Would you agree with that? More pure talent than anyone that's come into the league.
Yeah, I mean, from what I've seen, yes. I mean, you know, I'll play the fifth on LeBron just because I didn't see him when he was that age. I don't really remember. I was like 10. So, you know, I don't have the clearest memory of that time. But like, look, I mean, and someone made this point to me too, you know, a GM, that, you know, of all the players his age on the planet, I mean, he's the most skilled. I mean, maybe all teenagers on the planet, right? So then that's before you talk about him being 7'2" or 7'3" or 7'5" or, you know, whatever. It doesn't really matter, right? So, you know, I've gotten a lot of questions. Like, people, obviously, you get the comparison question a lot. People ask me that a lot, and it's hard. I mean, you know, I guess the most common one has been the Rudy Gobert, Kevin Durant fusion thing, which I've said before. Everyone's kind of said it before, but I don't think that really does it justice. And it's not saying he's going to be better than those guys or what, but it's just like, that doesn't really capture like why it's so weird. Like, it is just something that, yeah, I mean, you just said it. I mean, it's something that hasn't happened before. It's a player that hasn't existed before. And, you know, I think, you know, I've heard, you know, some of the, you know, older scouts throwing out like Lou Alcindor type comparisons in terms of just like how he moves and scores. And I mean, that's, you know, not for me to say, but I've heard that, you know, so, you know, we're getting all types of lofty stuff getting thrown out, but it doesn't feel weird because it's, and again, these were two games, but for him to, you know, play this well both times, again, now he's playing a G League team. It's not like he's playing against a real NBA team, but, you know, point being, he's 18, right? So there's so much room to improve. The hype feels very justified. It's hard not to get excited, right? I mean, it's hard to nitpick. I mean, I think there's things he can improve at. You know, the rebounding, I think we'll have to get a little bit better. He changes more shots. He changes a ton of shots. I think sometimes he's a step slow. Like, you know, Scoot was able to, you know, get around him and finish a couple times. He's not going to block every single shot, but he's going to alter a ton, right? Like, that, you know, alone is going to be there. That's kind of like a constant, right? So, there's so much to get excited about that it's hard to really nitpick. And again, I think the thing that we will hear is, you know, big 7-foot mobile guys come with some injury risk, but that's kind of like a truism, right? Like, that's not a Victor specific thing. You know, he has a history of injuries here and there, but I think they're very cognizant of that. Nothing has been serious with his lower body, and I think they're just trying to be cognizant moving forward.
Yeah, so that's what you say about everyone right. With that kind of frame. It's like, oh, well, right. What if he gets a foot injury? I mean, look out. And then there's right. The obligatory, he's got to add muscle. Look, that's A, obviously true, but B, I look at his body type. I don't know how you see it, but I look at that body type. Like, he's going to fill out like Giannis. Like, he is going to be, he's not, like, you don't look at him and see the next Chet Holmgren. You don't even look at him and see the next Kevin Durant in terms of body type. I look at him and I see Giannis body type, a body type that's going to be shredded once he gets into an NBA weight room over the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually very impressed physically too. You know, he is bigger in his upper body than I thought, I guess, but you know, I guess it's been a little while. Like, and he's had time to put some weight on. So, like, yeah, I don't have too many concerns about him putting on weight. I don't think he needs to be overly muscled anyway, frankly. Like, you know, there's something you add when you add the strength, but there's also things you lose when you add too much muscle. And that was something I brought up a lot with Chet in his case. And, you know, jury's out. We don't need to have that conversation right now. We'll see what happens when he gets healthy. But, yeah, I mean, I think it can really work. Just because it's a size skill league and he's just like the apex of that, you know, conversation, right? I mean, there hasn't been anyone with that combination. It's like the sliders are all the way up in both categories. But the other thing is he's so competitive, man. He handled himself so well. And I think that's part of the conversation that has to be also discussed. How comfortable and ready he seems for the moment, how sure he seems to be of himself. He did a really good job, you know, answering questions. His English is really good. He's going to be really marketable. Which is big for the NBA too, you know, having an international player who also is very going to be marketable immediately, doesn't have as much of a, you know, learning curve with the media. It's really, everybody should be excited. Except for all the, you know, where all the bad games are going to have to watch with everybody trying tanking, but, it'll be worth it for somebody.
when you kind of project him out into the league, and it doesn't matter as much as it used to because it's become a positionless game, the NBA, but like, is he kind of the, you know, supersize is the wrong word, but is he like the center that got bit by the spider bug? Like all of a sudden the supercharged center. We've seen centers become 3-point shooters over the last 10 years, but is he the guy that breaks the mold at the five? Does he become what, like, some people thought Porzingis was going to become over the last few years? Does he become that guy, the center? Or do you think, like, he's quick enough to defend fours that you could put him in at power forward? How do you kind of see him? How do teams see him?
Yeah. It seems to me like he's going to be more of a four on offense, right? Like, the Porzingis thing I've heard, people have mentioned that, like, what we had hoped he was going to be. Victor's more athletic, I think. Although, I mean, young Porzingis was pretty athletic before he was hurt all the time. But, you know, I think clearly, you know, with how comfortable he is handling the ball, you know, he can spend more time on the perimeter. So he's going to be, you know, more of a roving, like, type of four on offense who spaces. You can play him with another big, but you don't have to. He can close games at center. Defensively, yeah, I also think you can do both things. I mean, you'll be able to close with him at the five if you want. If you want to play another big to sort of protect him, you know, if the other team, say you're facing like a Valanciunas or a Capella or someone, you know, someone bruising or even an Embiid, like someone you just don't want Victor to have to guard the whole game. You know, you can play him with another big and it's not going to be a problem, right? So, like, I think that's a big part of the appeal when you're projecting him is he can play in all types of different lineups. And that's because, you know, defensively, you know, he can wall off, but he can also help over and block shots. He's really, really good at contesting shots. You know, he can get out and block stuff and he gets forward really well. He gets sideways really well. I mean, he covers ground. One, I think, interesting point, you know, I was talking to Jason Hart, the Ignite head coach, about this. And, you know, one of the things they were trying to do in these two games was just put him in, you know, ball screen coverage when they could and just see how he handled it. And then, you know, that's something you'll have to learn. But I mean, I think he can be a monstrous ball screen defender because he can play drop and then still get a really good contest if you settle for a 15 footer, right? Like, say you're trying to stop and pop it. Free throw line. I mean, he can still get there. So it's, again, everything really breaks convention. It's hard to say with certainty, but also, like, it's not hard not to get so excited. I mean, I feel like I'm getting carried away and I don't do this a lot. Like, I'm pretty tempered usually when I talk about players, just cause I have seen a lot of things go wrong, but this is the type of guy. I mean, even the most cynical people I've talked to around the NBA are pretty overwhelmed by, you know, what it could be.
So. I mean, you mentioned playing on ball screen. There were two, like, iconic photos that came from that series of games. One was the one where I think he was coming around and defending on a ball screen where he had, like, it was his left hand out and Scoot Henderson had the ball on his right and it was pulled back. And Wembanyama is so long that he was able to make contact with the ball, reaching it across the body of Scoot Henderson. That was wild. The other one that struck me was he had a dunk where when his hand was pushing it through the rim, as I'm leaning back doing this podcast, his head was past the side of the backboard. It was past the side of the backboard. The fucking guy is dunking when he's past the side of the backboard. It was wild. The physical tools on this guy, we've never seen anything like it. He's longer than Rudy. Like, he's not only taller than Rudy, but he's longer than Rudy. And Rudy, as we've said many times, is a walking top five, top 10 defense. Like, you know, he's not as strong as Rudy right now, but he certainly could come into the league with just that in his bag. Like, let me be a great, you know, defensive player where even if I'm not leading the league in blocks, I'm leading the league in chain shots or contests or all the crazy things that we're seeing these super athletic guys do.
Yeah, and remember, I mean, and Rudy came into the league older, too. I don't remember how old he was, but he was not 18 when, or 19 when he came into the NBA. It was a little bit later. He was still a, sort of a project. So, yeah, it was those players, but then also I think the two players for me, you know, sitting pretty close to the court, there was the one play in the first game where he's coming up in the fast break. He, like, hits ahead and then, like, signals to the guard and then takes a dribble handoff and just, like, stop and pop, like, leaning to the left, like, from, like, the left side, and it was right in front of me, and that was when I was just like shaking my head. I don't know if I'm on camera or not, but I was just blew my mind. And then there was the other player everybody talked about where he on the fast break dribbles all the way into the corner to take that three-point shot and hits it like fading to the side. And then, you know, he showed the mid-range stuff. I mean, there's really not a lot he can't do. Yeah, I mean, I want to say there's going to be a little bit of a learning curve because there always is. And, you know, physically, you guys are going to hit him. And it already happens. And the refs already don't know how to officiate him. That's one other thing. I'm sure there will be some prerogative from the league to try to protect him a little bit. But, like, you know, apparently it's happening in France, too. You know, the refs call, you know, they can't call everything on him because guys are hitting him all the time. You can't call every single foul. But then also the goaltending. I mean, there was the one missed goal, or they called that one shot a goaltend. And the ball was clearly still going up. But just, like, you're not used to someone getting the ball that high, right? So I think it's like a visual trick for the refs. So, you know, they're going to have to learn how to, you know, deal with him too. We're all going to have to figure it out. So,
these small market teams, whether it's San Antonio, Utah, I'll even throw Oklahoma City in that mix. You never know what they're going to do. Indiana, if they break the whole thing up and decide to tank, like, I get it. You have a chance to get at a minimum, what is it, like 8 years out of a guy when you talk about the first contract into the second contract, like before a player option would potentially kick in. Like, I get it. You know, I think I hate tanking. It's bad basketball. But if you're trying to put yourself in the best position to draft this guy, you got to do it. Like, not since LeBron have we had a player worth it, like worth mailing in the season for, I think. And that's why, you know, Howard Beck and I are we get into this on at the top of the show, but like there's going to be some of the most brazen tanking to make sure you get inside that top three that we've seen, I think, in a long time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you're going to see also, you know, someone always starts, you know, 3-10 or, you know, 4-12 or whatever, like who's not expecting it. Like, things always kind of go wrong. And, you know, whoever that team happens to be this year, you know, might be a couple of them, like, you know, from the middle of the pack, who aren't expecting to be that bad. I mean, they're going to have a tough decision to make. But I think it's a valid point and it's been made, but like, it's way easier to, you know, explain to ownership why it's worth it now. Like, hey, just watch these two games. You know, like, it doesn't seem like as hard of a sell now, you know, if it ever was, as to, you know, why this guy's a big deal and why it's such a, you know, franchise changing thing. But also, I do think I'll add, like, you know, from what I've heard, and this weekend I went to Colorado Springs to watch, you know, young high school kids at USA Basketball, you know, get a sense of what's coming. But, you know, the people I talked to there too, I mean, you know, scouts have been out at practices and pro days and stuff for the last few weeks. So that's kind of back in full swing as far as this year's draft. And people are excited about the depth of this class. You know, I think it's looking really good. You know, it helps with the whole tanking thing too, is it's like, yeah, you know, you're not going to be unhappy if you get Scoot Henderson. And he's
that was going to be my last question here on Scoot. Like, game one, like, he was awesome. Like, he looks like a ready to step in point guard right away. I don't know what you compare him to. I saw some of the Russell Westbrook comparisons. He's certainly got the athleticism to meet that comp. Like, I guess put it this way, if Scoot Henderson was eligible this past year when teams are going back and forth on Paolo and Chet and Jabari Smith, like, would he have been the top pick in this past draft, and how good is he?
Yeah, I think there's a pretty real chance he would have at least, I can say for sure he would have been part of that conversation. You know, he's really gotten a lot better, I think, since March too. Like, that was part of what was cool about it, is he really showed what he'd been working on, you know, as a number one type caliber prospect. I mean, he's so quick with the ball. You know, he told me, I talked to him, you know, one-on-one last week, and, you know, he looks leaner this year. It's on purpose. He maintained his playing weight But, you know, all of his training in the offseason was trying to shed. I thought he was a little bit like thicker last year, and he was trying to shed that and be a little bit more, even faster and quicker. And I think it's evident. You know, his injury, they called it a bone bruise. You know, Ignite won't play for another few weeks, so my guess is he won't miss much time, if any, at all, hopefully. But yeah, I mean, look, as a native Chicagoan, we always, I don't want to like throw the Derrick Rose comparison out because I treat that young Derrick Rose with a lot of reverence. But I wasn't the only person who said it. Like, that was kind of what I thought the first time I saw some of these highlights from last year. And he was pretty good at times. He was really good at times in the G League last year. So, you know, they're playing a full schedule with Ignite. You know, they're playing the full like 50 game G League slate. So that's going to be taxing. You know, we'll see how he holds up if he plays the whole thing. But regardless, he's on a really, really promising trajectory. I do think he's going to be, you know, the goal for him, I think, is to come in and start on day one. You know, he's going to be more in that, in the Rose, John Wall vein of like really fast guy who makes plays rather than like, you know, at least right now. That's what it projects to be, right? Like that type of high octane, up-tempo guard. But, you know, physically he checks the boxes, and I think defensively he can keep getting better. His passing's gotten better. Like, that was my main thing last year, you know, having seen Knight play live probably like 5 times last season. It was just, you know, how long will it take him to really learn to run a team? And they've really been working on bringing that out of him too, like vocally and talking and bringing that personality out. And he's getting better at it. So he's a real, really, really legit worker. He's all business. He didn't even really want to talk about the number one stuff with Victor. We all know he wanted it, but he did a good job of kind of like deflecting it. But he's coming, man. Like, he's going to be, you know, a rookie of the year contender, right, next year. One of the better guard prospects in a while. I think at least since Ja Morant. Like, I don't know if I'm ready to say he was a better prospect than Ja Morant, because I think Ja Morant was a really good prospect with the passing he had. But can he have that type of impact for a franchise? I think that's what the hope has to be, right? The way that Ja has kind of turned around Memphis. So,
well, one thing we know, he could average 50 points, 15 assists, and 10 rebounds, and he still wouldn't go number one.
It would be tough.
There's no GM on this earth that would take, and look, you are way more plugged in on this than I am, but like, when I was texting some people during that game, like, the obsession was real. Like, the drool, you know, that you could almost see over the phone from the mouth of some of these guys. I mean, this guy, you know, I can't wait. I usually go into the lottery room every year, and I can't wait to do it again this year just to watch the reaction.
You're going
to
have fun.
The representative for that team, that like to see who gets one and their reaction, and see who gets two and three and their reaction. You could squeeze 2,500 words out of that, that's for sure. So, it'll be wild, that's for sure to see. Jeremy, good stuff last week with all the stuff with Victor, with Scoot Henderson. Your mock draft, I'm sure, will be coming very soon, right? I'm sure we can predict the top, but...
Yeah, I can tell you who 1 and 2 is right now.
You gotta love it, man. Well, appreciate the time, man.
Appreciate it, yeah, man. Anytime.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.